Kildare Today with Owen Beattie.
With Whitewater Shopping Centre Newbridge, Ireland's largest regional shopping centre. Fashion, food, film, all under one roof in the heart of Newbridge. WhitewaterSC.ie.
Welcome back to the programme. Now, huge numbers of people with an alcohol problem cannot get access to quick treatment, according to a new report. Service providers say there are serious unmet mental health needs among many of those seeking help. The report, entitled Alcohol Treatment Services, a Snapshot Survey, is published on this morning, by Alcohol Action Ireland. And to discuss this, I'm joined by Dr. Joe Barry, Adjunct Professor of Public Health Medicine at Trinity College Dublin and board member of Alcohol Action Ireland. Dr. Barry, good morning and welcome to the programme again.
You're welcome.
This programme is, or this report, I should say, is it worrying on the outset looking in on it, or is it something that you would have expected to come from the report?
Well, it's a bit of each, I think, Owen. It is worrying and it's not unexpected. I mean, I think we all know in this country by now that there is a fairly big problem with alcohol amongst lots of people, and this report suggests up to a quarter of a million people are alcohol dependent. This is from the Health Research Board, which, that's a lot of people, and about half of those are parents of small children. So, you know, there's a lot of evidence that children who grow up where there's a lot of alcohol there are certain traumas that occur, and that doesn't bode well necessarily for later life for them. And I suppose the problem really is the scale of the issue. To really try and get to grips with addressing the health needs of all these people requires a lot of resources, a lot of skilled counsellors, a lot of beds, residential beds. Now, it's not all about residential beds, but they are important, and aftercare is very important, because it's often said, oh, giving up drink is very easy to do, I've done it 10 times, you know. So people do have relapses, and better aftercare lessens that happening. But people always need ongoing emotional support, and that's a skill in itself. Like, if you go to a cancer treatment unit, you expect the people there to have a high level of skill in relation to treating cancer. And we're saying the same, that expanding the service will have to be accompanied by recruitment of more skilled people. There are skilled people already, but there's just not enough of them.
And just to reiterate that figure that you mentioned, according to the report, there's an estimated quarter of a million people with alcohol dependency problems, yet the latest data is showing only 3,500 new cases gain access to some form of treatment programme. So like you touched on there, that is a very small percentage.
It's tiny, and there is a lot of evidence that there are times when people are ready to give up and times when they're not. So we're not talking about everybody who's alcohol dependent coming in to get dried out. We're talking about the people who really believe that they're ready for it get an opportunity. Now, that can be residential, it can be day programs, or a combination. So we're really trying to increase the preparedness, like the country prepared for COVID. But COVID is on the down now, whereas mental health issues, addiction issues, it really came to the fore in COVID. Mm. And the mental health is, and addiction together, is called dual diagnosis. So we need a ramped up strategy for the treatment of alcohol. We have networks of clinics for people who are using heroin and other illicit drugs, but there is the numbers needing help for alcohol far outweighs all the other drugs put together, and that's the point of this report. One is just to highlight that amongst the public, amongst your listeners, and ask for more extensive service responses to be available, and that there wouldn't be big long waiting lists, because a waiting list is no use if you've decided you're ready to seek support and help. Being told, well, we'll call you back in 2 months, that's no good, you know.
But essentially, in a nutshell, what you're saying there is we're missing a lot of people who are committed in their own heads to giving up alcohol. They go, they reach out for the help, and then they're told the help essentially is not available, and then, you know, it might be too late then by the time, you know, we get around to that person.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, we have estimated a quarter of a million and 3,000 and 3,500 people getting treatment, so that's only about less than 2%, you know.
There was also an associated article in the Irish Times today, not related to the report carried out by Alcohol Action Ireland, but just ties in with what we're talking about. The headline, Ireland only one of two European countries where drinking did not fall during the pandemic. There were significant decreases in average consumption of alcohol in all 21 European countries surveyed for the research, except in the UK and Ireland. So it further highlights that alcohol consumption remains a big issue here in this country.
Yes, it does. And as I said, that is highlighted, as you say, during COVID. It is, because it's very available. We have a very strong culture. You know, all our social events are linked to alcohol. It's tough for a teenager who doesn't really want to drink, because they can be marginalised and seen as antisocial. So we have a very strong culture, or where we're looking that the link between alcohol and sport should be broken. And the government has committed to looking at that, but they haven't done it. I mean, I think, you know, it's these drinks companies, you know, they're making lots of profit. And they were asked at one stage that the levy would be imposed, and they said no. So there is a loss to be done, for sure, because we have lots of problems, and most people will know somebody close to them in their family or friends whose lives have really been damaged by alcohol use.
One finding as well that stood out to me, Dr. Barry, from this report: children often go unnoticed in the programmes of those seeking treatment. 50% of those in treatment are father or mothers with children having to share the journey to recovery. So it is a family illness, so to speak. We've talked about that before. It doesn't just impact the person who is alcohol dependent. It impacts the entire family.
Yeah, we in Alcohol Action Ireland have a programme, or an initiative called Hidden Harms, you know, because these are hidden harms, and children need support if their parents are drinking. So there's a role there for, there's a role there for TUSLA, there's a role there for the mental health services. It's a more, and there's a midterm review of the National Drug and Alcohol Strategy going on at the moment by the Department of Health, and hopefully they will increase the supports available for alcohol, because most of the drug alcohol funding goes to treatment of illicit drug use, and that's required as well, of course. So we're talking about an extra increase in funding. It depends on what the priority will be. Like, the country spent billions on COVID. Alcohol is there, and it'll be there long after COVID.
And just finally then, Dr. Barry, just to reiterate the proposed recommendations that Alcohol Action are proposing in relation to this report.
Well, there's just a couple. We want sort of a HICWEL type standards in residential alcohol treatment settings, like happens in other residential health settings in Ireland. We want a refocusing of the National Drug Strategy to give more prominence to alcohol treatment, and to tell us exactly how much money is spent on it. I think the HSE spends about $159 million a year on their drug and alcohol services. Now, I don't know how much of that is drugs and how much is alcohol, but that needs to be done for any county in Ireland, for any, you know, because local people, your listeners, will want to know, where can I go? Or where can I go if I want help, or if one of my family members wants help and they want help? You know, and if the queues are long, they need to see their TDs and say, listen, we really need a better response than this.
Well, Dr. Joe Barry, Adjunct Professor of Public Health Medicine at Trinity College Dublin and Board Member of Alcohol Action Ireland, on that report, which is available to view on the Alcohol Action website. Many thanks for joining us on the programme again, Dr. Barry, and good morning to you. Just to give some numbers as well, if you have been impacted by the discussion that myself and Dr. Barry have had, you can call Alcoholics Anonymous on 01 842 0700. That's 01 842 0700, and you can also email gso@alcoholicsanonymous.ie. Let's go to Studio 2 and Ciara Noble.
Yes, thank you very much, Owen. So yesterday, people may know that Cabinet signed off on proposals ensuring all renters, including students, will not have to pay multiples of monthly rent amounts when signing a tenancy agreement. Chris Pender, councillor for Kildare Newbridge Municipal District, joins me now to discuss the issue. Chris, you have noted that this will only benefit a small percentage of people.
Yeah, so, sorry, I'm dropping my phone on me. So essentially what we're looking at here is we're looking at guidelines that are not, like, they're protecting a tiny, tiny amount of people, and we still have people who are facing into a point now where in July the timeline for increase of rents under the rent pressure zones will be coming up, so people are facing an 8% increase as well on top of it. God, I'm after dropping everything.
That's okay, don't worry. The obviously there are complicated rules, and they only apply to those who have already been behind on their rent and declared that they cannot pay it because of COVID-19. Now, you want the rental terms and conditions to be completely rewritten. What would that look like to you?
So essentially what we're looking for, it's not just rental terms and conditions being completely rewritten. What we need for rental terms to be brought in line with European standards. We need for renters' rights to be brought in line with European standards, and we need a situation where we have, for instance, a rent freeze in the country. Now, I think we all know that we got one throughout the pandemic, even though prior to that it was apparently deemed unconstitutional, except for in a health crisis. Now, I don't know about you, but sorry, except for in a time of national crisis. But I don't know about you. Now, to me, a homelessness crisis is a national crisis, just as much as a pandemic is. To rewrite. Going over my own words now. In order to rewrite renters' rights, what we would need to do is we would need to sit down and have a person-centred approach, ensuring that we have, for instance, deposit protections for people, so that we're not relying on a landlord coming in and essentially stating that damages that were pre-existing before somebody moved in were damages that renter did. So you're talking about a deposit protection scheme in cases like that. So that there's essentially a third party that will be responsible for your deposit, or that your deposit is protected, that you have these things in place that you could essentially, well, this is what the place looked like before I moved in, this is what the place now looks like after I've moved out. All of these things that you're saying I am responsible for are not something I'm responsible for, and that you could then appeal to have your deposit returned to you. Like, I've had multiple constituents where I've had to engage with their former landlords to the deposit, claiming that general wear and tear on a carpet was their responsibility.
Unfortunately, Chris, your line is just very bad there this morning, but we do thank you for joining us, Social Democrats Councillor Chris Pender for the Kildare Newbridge area. And just to let people know, as I mentioned, Cabinet, they did sign off on the proposals, so all renters, that includes students, obviously very of the minute at the moment with the Leaving Cert underway for the second day, they won't have to now fork out multiples of their monthly rent amounts when signing these agreements. But as Chris says, he believes this will only affect just a small percentage of people. So the government to have passed these laws by the summer, renters will only be required to supply a deposit and a month's rent in advance. And the total value will not be allowed to exceed the value of 2 months' rent. Owen.
All right, thanks for that, Ciara. Just to move on then, FORSA, SIPTU and Connect trade unions, which collectively represent 30,000 local authority workers across Ireland, have officially launched the second phase of its campaign to reclaim the role of local authorities and local democracy at a meeting with officials from three unions. More Power to You was launched first in 2019 with the aim of enhancing local democracy and to start a conversation about the future of local government. To talk more about this, Peter Nolan, National Secretary with FORSA, is on the line. Peter, good morning. Welcome to the programme again.
Good morning, Owen.
Just tell us a little bit about this More Power to You project and what exactly it is.
Well, Owen, we're trying to start a debate in Ireland about the role of local government. In Ireland, local government is the Cinderella of democracy, democratic institutions. And we found ourselves having commissioned a report in relation to this, which finds Ireland to be the worst out of 54 countries in Europe in relation to the way it organises its local government services. And we're talking about things like the level of representation, the amount of expenditure in the economy through the local government system. If you take a country like Denmark, you'll find that 68% of all public expenditure is spent through the local government system. In Ireland, the comparable figure is 8%. So we really want to get a debate going. We believe that local democracy is a basis in which we can unpick some of the problems that are occurring throughout Irish society, that distance and gap that people feel between the institutions of state and their own local communities. So that's why we launched the campaign.
Yeah, this is the second phase then of the campaign, and we're told it will seek a citizens' assembly to examine the role of local democracy in Ireland, lobbying at national level for enhanced local government, briefing with local authorities, submissions to local development plans, and so on. There's five pillars of the campaign. Just go through some of them for us, please.
Okay, well, democracy itself is at the core of it. With that connection with the community, last time out, we saw, without much debate in Ireland, town councils such as Newbridge and Naas being abolished without any debate. This was an opportunity for social and economic development. So we want a review in relation to that. There is a citizens' assembly going to discuss the role of a directly elected mayor in Dublin, and we believe that should be expanded to have a debate in relation to the role of local government throughout the country and to bring services closer to delivery of the community.
Okay, let's just deal with that point then on democracy, okay. Because you mentioned Naas and Newbridge town councils, the fact that they were abolished. So at the moment we have municipal districts. So there's a Naas municipal district, there's a Kildare-Newbridge municipal district. What is the difference between an MD and a town council, and do you feel as though the current structure is not adequate?
Yeah, we believe that not sufficient thought was put into the creation of municipal districts. Municipal districts effectively have divided towns, giving a portion of the county to each of the towns, and has prevented the kind of dynamism that's created by the prospect of attracting economic and social development into a town. So up and down the country, and including Kildare, town councils have been dismantled by the creation of municipal districts. So we do believe that's a retrograde step. We actually believe the people who thought of this on the first occasion have reviewed their thinking in relation to it. We have the lowest level of representation in Europe of, as they say, 54 countries. So we believe this debate is something that the community will connect with. We believe that there's a role, for instance, for local government in terms of the creation of microgeneration of energy. We believe, very importantly, at the moment, the government set carbon emission targets based on each government department, the Department of Justice, Department of Transport, etc. What if carbon emission targets were set at the level of each county? If Kildare, if Dublin, if Meath, if Wicklow were the ones who were defining what the carbon emissions, wouldn't that create for a greater opportunity for the community to combine, stop these artificial divides between different industries, between agriculture and aviation? Let's do it based on the county boundary. And one of the things we have in Ireland, one of the great assets we have, is a tremendous affinity with county. It's unsurpassed throughout Europe, but yet at the same time, we have the weakest system of local government. What if we put those two things together?
So that's two of the pillars, democracy, energy. I just want to move on to housing, because that is something that obviously has been in the headlines over the last couple of weeks. You're calling for an audit of land banks available to local authorities for the construction of social and affordable housing. Now, we were told by a local councillor on the programme yesterday that there are up to 10,000 houses in Kildare that have been granted planning permission, but the building hasn't actually started on any of these houses. So it's not to do really with the accessibility to houses, or like the houses are there ready to go, they're just not being built.
Well, the housing problem is complex. One of the debates that we're talking about in terms of local government is identifying the amount of public land that's available to go for publicly constructed housing. The issue in relation to planning permission and planning sites is a different one, but we have a voice in relation to that too. I think people ought not to be able to look for planning permission without a real intent of developing sites in order to get proper housing delivered to people. And I think that's a speculative concern that would be removed if we looked to local authorities to be the engine of housing delivery.
All right, very interesting indeed. We'll wait and see what happens. That is Peter Nolan, National Secretary of FORSA, as three trade unions, FORSA, SIPTU and Connect, are calling for empowered local government with greater control over public services. And as always, Peter Nolan, many thanks for your time on the programme.
Kildare Today with Owen Beattie.
With Whitewater Shopping Centre Newbridge, Ireland's largest regional shopping centre. Fashion, food, film, all under one roof and the heart of Newbridge. WhitewaterSC.ie.
You're very welcome back to the show. Now, herd immunity, it's the indirect protection from an infectious disease that happens when a population is immune, either through vaccination or immunity developed through previous infection. That is the definition from the World Health Organization. Now, they did note in January of this year that herd immunity globally will not happen in 2021. But how close is Ireland to it? I'm joined by Professor Kingston Mills. He's an Experimental Immunology School of Biochemistry professor at Trinity College Dublin. Good morning, Kingston.
Good morning.
Tell us, how close is the country to herd immunity?
I'm afraid nowhere near it. As you said in your introduction, herd immunity is when a significant proportion of the population are immune either by vaccination, two doses of the vaccine, or by previous infection. And we've vaccinated a significant number of people with one dose, but it's a relatively smaller number with two doses. And we know, in particular with the Delta variant, that two doses are required to confer protective immunity. So, and also people who've recovered from infection have good antibody responses, at least for a significant number of months, 9 months or more. So they're also protected. But even accounting for all of those, we're probably at 20 to 30% of people in the country would be considered to have protection against the virus right now. So it can take a good while longer.
Yeah, they believe 2 in 10 people in this country have received 2 doses. And as you said, 2 doses are more effective against the Delta variant originating in India. And if you do just take the development of the vaccine for COVID-19 in general, it was obviously developed against the original strain. So does that mean that in all likelihood for us to reach herd immunity, we will also need to be vaccinating the children of this country, as just adults would say vaccination and would say the majority of them actually taking up the option to get vaccinated, we'd only probably be around the 60% mark.
Yeah, I mean, well, around 1 million people in this country are under the age of 18. So if you want to, and the total population of 5 million or thereabouts, it means that it's virtually impossible to reach herd immunity without vaccinating adolescents under 18. So, the US have already started. The FDA have now approved Pfizer and about to approve the Moderna vaccines for children. The EMA have approved the Pfizer vaccine for children, and it seems likely that many European countries now will start, once they finish the vaccination of adults, will start into vaccinating children. And that's children over 12. And the US are now looking at also doing clinical trials to start it on children under the age of 12, because there's evidence that they can also get infected. They don't get significant disease, but they can transmit it. And of course, in Ireland, a lot of the current cases of COVID-19 are in the younger population, mainly because they haven't been vaccinated and the older population have. So we do need to vaccinate the younger children. Now, the other issue, of course, is that we know from studies done in England, Public Health England published about 2 weeks ago, showed that one dose of either the Pfizer or the AstraZeneca vaccine were not particularly effective, about 33% effective against the Delta variant. And we also showed that the Pfizer vaccine had around 88% efficacy with two doses, whereas the AstraZeneca was 60. So that's telling us if we rely heavily on the AstraZeneca vaccine to confer immunity, we will never reach herd immunity.
And that's exactly what I wanted to mention to you, was the vaccine efficacy. So we are told against COVID-19, the original strain, the AstraZeneca vaccine after the first dose can give you up to 76% immunity. So that means that 76% of people who received that vaccination were protected from COVID. The second dose, it goes up to about 86 or 82%. Then Pfizer, it's around 91%. You look at something similar with Moderna, etc. This is all against the original strain.
Yeah.
So should we just throw these figures out the window? And I know that will be very frustrating to the general public and listeners, Kingston, hearing that, like, we've heard these numbers, great, we've this much percentage efficacy, but it is against the original strain, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, we don't throw them out the window. And the good news is that Ireland still has a relatively small number of cases of Delta variant. You know, it's quite low here, worryingly. The UK, it's now the dominant version of the virus in the UK. About 75% of all cases are the Delta variant, and there have been a number of cases, I think up to 80 in Northern Ireland. So obviously travel from the UK is contributing significantly to that. And if we don't, I mean, it's quite remarkable that we don't have the UK on our red list, and we have other countries which don't have significant levels of the Delta variant on our red list. So, you know, we're asking for trouble in terms of, you know, re-importing the problem. I mean, we were very close to getting the thing under complete control, and it looks very good in that we don't have people going to hospital anymore. We have very few deaths from COVID-19. Everything is going fantastically with the vaccine rollout. But the real issue for the future is, can we keep the Delta variant out and make sure that the vaccine that we're using protects against the virus that's circulating? Right now, it's good. But if that Delta variant was to get hold in the south, then we could be in trouble. In the UK, the numbers of hospitalizations are starting to creep up in Northern England, and that's a direct result of the Delta variant. And there are what we call vaccine breakthrough cases now being reported. I was on the phone this morning to the Times of India, and they're reporting significant numbers of cases of what they call vaccine breakthroughs. In other words, people who have been either given one or two doses of vaccines, and in India they're using a local vaccine made by Bharat Biotech, but also the AstraZeneca vaccine. So they're documenting, as the UK are, what we call vaccine breakthroughs. Worrying.
Kingston, I just finally, I want to, you know, as we know, a lot of things come up on the internet nowadays that are speculating they're true about COVID-19, etc., etc. But when it comes to variants, is it more likely that variants develop within younger populations?
No. I mean, the variant can develop in any aged person, and it's more likely to develop in somebody that's immune suppressed, because what happens there is that the virus is not as well controlled, and it replicates very effectively, and the more it replicates, the more chance it has to mutate and change and then get selected. And it's natural selection. What's happening is the virus is changing, and the one that's more infectious or more transmissible gets selected because it has a selective advantage. This is just normal natural selection that occurs in every animal species as well as viruses. So this is, you know, it was to be expected from viruses. It's what's been happening with influenza for hundreds of years. And, you know, we didn't think it was going to happen to the same extent with SARS-CoV virus 2, but it is, unfortunately. Now, the good news is, just to leave it on a positive note, is that the companies are all frantically working on versions of the vaccines that will take care of these variants. So they're already in, they don't have to go through the big phase 3 trials to do this. They just do a small trial with the new version of the vaccine, which will be specifically designed to protect against the variants. And they're already in testing and should be ready, you know, in a couple of months. So we can envisage in the autumn, when everybody has been vaccinated, starting again and vaccinating everybody again with the vaccine, or boosting them at least.
Kingston, I know obviously as a professor of immunology, you're not a betting man, but if you had to, give me a year right now where we could actually envision a herd immunity in this country.
I don't think it's likely in the foreseeable future for several years. I don't think any country is going to reach herd immunity, because of the variants and the fact that you need to vaccinate. So to sum it up, you need to vaccinate around over 80% of the population with a vaccine that has over 90% efficacy to get herd immunity against the variants. And you can see the issue is that if you're going to vaccinate all children as well as adults and you don't have a vaccine that's over 90%, then it's impossible. It doesn't mean you can't protect most of the population. I mean, herd immunity is good, but it's not the only way of protecting people.
Yes.
I don't want to be negative on that. I think we've done a great job and we're protecting lots of people, and lots of people have been stopped from going to hospital and dying from this. So that's the really good news.
Yeah, and we like to leave it on a positive note. Thank you so much. You always have so much time for us here at KFM. Kingston Mills, Professor of Experimental Immunology at the School of Biochemistry and Immunology at Trinity College Dublin. Over to you, Owen.
Well, Irish Rail is to start issuing fines for antisocial behaviour and drinking to curb gangs of young people who have been involved in violent incidents along the Dart Line and the villages that it serves. Security is also being ramped up on trains and in stations, with CCTV being setting up as well at some stations. Joining me now is spokesperson for Irish Rail, Jane Cregan. Jane, good morning to you.
Morning, Owen. How are you?
Just to take a look at this then, the on-the-spot fines that are going to be introduced, is that just on the Dart Line or also on train station lines as well, such as the Arrow Line?
No, we're looking at it on all services, but I suppose we are a little bit away from issuing the first fines. Basically, under the Railway Safety Act 2005, we have legislative powers to penalise those who engage in antisocial behaviour. There's a wide variety of antisocial behaviour, including abuse of alcohol, vandalism, abusive behaviour. It's all set out within the Act, but currently we would only prosecute people who are engaging this type of behaviour through a court summons system. Obviously, that's a lot slower than on the spot fines, similar to what we do with fare evasion at the moment. So we're currently working on to resource that to train authorised officers who could issue these fines, so that we can begin to do that to try and prevent the increase that we have seen in antisocial behaviour on our services.
Obviously, over the last year or so, there's been heightened security on public transport like trains, Dart services, because of the COVID-19 restrictions. Do you think that has possibly heightened the awareness of the security forces of what exactly happens on public transport?
I think a lot of it is to do with the fact that we've had so few people travelling. During the lockdowns, travel was restricted to 25%. For those who were essential workers or those who had to travel to care for a family member. But we did see during that time large amounts of youths and other people who were travelling with us who weren't travelling for essential reasons, but because they were out of school, out of college, didn't have any activities, they were hanging around train stations and travelling on our services. Obviously, when you're in a carriage with a very small number of people and you have people behaving in an antisocial way, it's even more threatening than if it was on a full carriage where you have the support of other people. So I suppose that's why it's been heightened and people are more aware of it. But it's something that we're working very closely with Dún Garda Síochána on. And even last weekend on your route, we had a joint operation between ourselves, our security contractors and the Garda Síochána to ensure that those travelling were doing so without causing any trouble to anybody else.
There's also, of course, the text alert service for antisocial behaviour that passengers can report this behaviour to the authorities. But we had you on, I think, towards the end of last year. Connolly Station was among the stations with the most text alerts for antisocial behaviour. That is also on the Maynooth line heading out there towards the town. So if people want to report such incidents, how can they do so?
Now, that's the text for antisocial behaviour, that is for just for the Dart Line.
Okay.
But obviously Connolly would have been included in that because it is part of the Dart Line. But I suppose if anyone does see any antisocial behaviour, anything that they feel worried by in the first instance, if they think that there is a threat to anybody, that they should contact the Gardaí. But also we do have large amounts of security travelling on our services now. We also have people at stations, and so if you see anything, please report it at the station. And it's very important for us as well that any instances like this are reported, because they help for us formulate our statistics to see where we need to deploy our resources and how best to deploy our resources. Now, what I would say, while we have seen an increase in antisocial behaviour, the vast majority of train trips in this country are undertaken without anybody witnessing or being victim of antisocial behaviour. But that's not to say that anyone who does witness or is victim of it is not very affected by it.
And just finally then, Jane, on a separate issue, today is International Level Crossing Awareness Day, and Erinrud Éireann warning road users to be vigilant at level crossings after there were 60 incidents recorded last year. And so far this year, 31 incidents at level crossings have been recorded across the network. So just a message to the public, I suppose, at those level crossings, when you see the barrier coming down, don't try and get in under the barrier before it closes.
Exactly, that's our message today, and it's backed up by the Road Safety Authority as well. Don't take risks at level crossings, obey the rules of the road. If you don't, it can have very serious consequences, both for the road and rail user.
Well, Jane Cregan, spokesperson with Irish Rail on those two issues, Erinrud Éireann to introduce on-the-spot fines to deter antisocial behaviour, and also today, International Level Crossing Awareness Day, just to be mindful of that. Jane, many thanks as always.